that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Just Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Orla Shinoui.
Hello, boys.
Almost said Daniel there. And a fourth guest, our youngest guest on the cycling podcast since Tailgagging Heart, Eve Shinoui, who is sitting on your knee, Orla. And Eve is how old?
She is 4.5 months. Do you want to say hello, Eve? Perfectly timed. Oh, my God, she's got a Korean broadcast.
I think we're going to get a bit more sense out of her than we normally get from Daniel, to be honest. Anyway, Orla and Eve, welcome to this week's packed cycling podcast. And we've got news from Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner, Brussels Koerner, the opening cobbled classics of the season. Interviews with Patrick Lefebvre, the boss of Etix Quickstep, Servais Canavan, the director sportif at Team Sky, and Luke Rowe from Team Sky. Some stuff from the Wiggle Honda women's team launch in Ghent, which was held just before Het Nieuwsblad, including an interview with Rochelle Gilmore, the team manager, about the future of the team and the health of women's cycling. Excitingly, this week, we're also announcing two new sponsors for the cycling podcast. We have Van Dessel Cycles, whose jingle you will hear and whose story we will be telling you over the coming weeks. And also British Eurosport, the home of cycling. In a new segment of the podcast, we'll be keeping you abreast of all the cycling coming up on British Eurosport. So a huge thank you, Van Dessel and British Eurosport, for supporting the cycling podcast, investing in it, and together with those who have signed up as friends, including Orla, as of today.
Yes, I have.
Well, thank you to you all for helping keep our weekly episodes free to air for anybody who wants to listen. Lionel, I think you've got your weekly roundup.
Yeah, the weekly news roundup. It's been another packed week. They're all going to be packed weeks now, aren't they? So perhaps I'll stop describing them as packed weeks from now on. But yeah, all eyes were on Belgium and the first cobbled classics of the season. Sky's Ian Stannard outwitted three Etix Quickstep riders to win Het Nieuwsblad for the second year in a row. And the following day, Mark Cavendish won Koerner Brussels Koerner for the second time in his career. There were also a couple of attempts on the hour record. Thomas Dekker fell 270 metres short of Rowan Dennis's mark of 52.419 kilometres, but he was quicker than Matthias Brandli and Jens Vogt, so he's second on the leaderboard at the moment. Quite a surprising performance, I would have thought, given his track technique was not exactly... It wasn't the smoothest. He was wobbling up by the red line on some of the turns towards the end, as the fatigue told. And Dame Sarah Story fell 563 metres adrift of Zillard van Moorsel's world hour record, the first woman to have a crack at that record for a good number of years. And in other news, Astana's UCI licence hangs in the balance after an independent audit, and it remains to be seen what implications there will be for Astana's Tour de France winner Vincenzo Nibali. Meanwhile, BMC Racing's Greg Van Avermaet is to appear before the Belgian Cycling Federation's disciplinary committee after being linked to an investigation into a doctor, Chris Mertens, and a controversial band treatment called ozone therapy, where blood is extracted, infused with ozone and re-injected, which sounds all a bit science fiction to me, but that's the week in news.
Is it not possible that Thomas Dekker actually did break the hour record if he wobbled so much around the track? Because, of course, the distance is calculated on number of laps rather than actual distance covered. So, if you know, it's possible.
Put an old Garmin on that and see, actually, the real distance covered. That would be quite interesting.
But anyway, let's not waste any more time on that, because we do want to get on with chatting about the cobbled classics, Het Nieuwsblad in particular. Remember when you asked Daniel if he was looking forward to Het Nieuwsblad, he decided it as a cracker. And it was a cracker this year. It was a brilliant race. It's often a brilliant race. As you said, I think, Lionel, a mini Tour of Flanders. It's like a greatest hits almost. It's got a lot of the familiar climbs and cobbled bergs and cobbled stretches. And it saw a very competitive race this year. The action really began about 50 kilometres out when Luke Rowe bridged up to the two survivors from an early breakaway, Matt Brammeer and somebody else whose name escapes me, Matt Brammeer and There was one other survivor. I'm going to look that up in a second. Anyway, Luke Rowe bridged up to him, and that really seemed to spark off the race itself. Tom Boonen went away with two Etics Quickstep teammates, Nicky Terpstra and Steen van den Berg, both very strong riders, and Ian Stannard, last year's winner, joined them. Stannard broke his back 11 months ago in Gent-Wevelgem and is really still returning to his previous level. So he joined them. At that point, you're looking at a breakaway, three Etics Quickstep riders. They're the strongest Cobble Classics team. Boonen and Terpstra are two of the strongest riders over that sort of terrain, and one Skyrider sitting on the back. You're not giving the Skyrider much hope there, are you, Lionel?
Well, no, but it's easy to say, well, three against one, they definitely should have won. And all of us armchair director sportifs would no doubt have watched the final kilometres and thought, well, they must work out a way to work Ian Stannard over. Obviously, they got it wrong because they didn't win the race. But it's not necessarily as easy as saying, well, we've got three and Ian Stannard's on his own. Steen van den Berg, he'd done a lot of work early on. Tom Boonen's move probably wasn't the most well-timed.
5 kilometres, he jumped away, where he is on paper the fastest sprinter, you'd have thought.
Yeah, well, it was a surprise. I thought the logical idea would be to send Nicky Terpstra up for maybe, perhaps not 5 kilometres out, 4 kilometres out, do what he did in Paris-Roubaix last year, and force Ian Stannard to chase. Having Boonen up there as the fastest sprinter, rather than sitting in the group waiting for Terpstra to be brought back, it didn't look like the most logical thing to have done. But we're not necessarily party to how everybody was feeling. We, you know, everybody isn't on the same amount of energy. It's not like a sort of computer game where, you know, you can just assume that so and so is strongest, he's second strongest, he's third strongest. Yes, on paper, yes, at the start of the race, but after the efforts of the entire race, it doesn't necessarily follow that the most logical thing should happen. And Ian Stannard played it absolutely perfectly.
Boonen himself, though, said that he thought it was a mistake that they didn't wait on the sprint, so he admits that it was an error in tactics, and it's all very well to say on paper that they should have done this, that, on the or the other, but according to him, they got it wrong, and they should have waited in the sprint. And in hindsight, that's what we would all have said, because Stannard is never going to win a sprint against Tom Boonen, and I think tactically they got that one wrong, whatever Patrick Lefebvre had to say afterwards.
Interesting and amazingly, Boonen has never won that race. Mm. And I was speaking to Hugo Kurowitz from Het Nieuwsblad, who said that Boonen, as he sort of nears the end of his career, the autumn of his career, he described it as, you know, he's very conscious of races that he hasn't won and which he's keen to add to his palmarès. I think that they thought that whoever they sent up the road was going to win it, and it was just a case of picking the rider. Leaving it to the sprint would have been risky. Allowing Terpstra to be the guy to attack at 4 kilometres out or something would have meant that Terpstra would have won the race. But the other factor that we haven't mentioned is that behind was a chasing group that closed at one point to 20 seconds. Sepp van Marck was leading that. He had been in the front group. I think he was the strongest in the front group. The motorbikes in front of the race were struggling to get the way when they first went clear. He then punctured out that group, joined up with Greg van Avermaet and Zdenek Stibar behind another Etics Quickstep rider. And that group was coming up fast. Van Marck was certainly a danger. He's a former winner of that race as well. So there was that factor too. No race radios as well.
Do you think, either of you, that in any way then Etics Quickstep were disadvantaged by the fact they had three riders, because they had three different cards to play, whereas Ian Stannard simply had to play poker and wait until they had played all their cards and then go for it? Was that, in the end, a bit of a disadvantage to having a quick step in a bit of an ironic way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very easy to think that might is right, and if you've got three men, that you're going to win. And in fact, they probably had too many options open to them, theoretically at least. And then if you consider, you know, as soon as the pressure went on, van den Berg went backwards. When Boonen was caught, and then Terpstra and Stannard, Boonen just couldn't close that gap, so he'd spent all of his energy on that move that didn't work. But they had a kind of an embarrassment of options, and they chose the wrong one. But as you say, Richard, at the time, you know, nobody chooses the wrong option on purpose. They chose what they thought was the best strategy at the time, and it didn't work. But Stannard, in his mind, he had none of that confusion. He really had one way to play the finish of the race, and that was to make sure he wasn't necessarily chasing, you know, the wrong time and for too long. He had to get that gap closed to Terpstra as quickly as he could, get on the wheel and recover. But of course, once he got there, there was no onus on him to contribute again. So all the cards had kind of fallen in his direction, really, and all he had to do was just sort of show his hand at the right moment, which was in the finishing straight, and he played it perfectly.
Let's not forget that Stannard did have a long time sitting on the wheels, you know, a good 35 kilometres or so, where he really didn't have to do very much at all. Now, Servais Canavan afterwards said that it's still hard. It was quite a windy day. It's not easy sitting there, but it's easier than riding on the front. And he did have an easier ride than the three in front of him who were working.
He certainly did, and I think we've got an interview with Patrick Fever coming up where he was certainly very critical of Stannard afterwards and saying that he should have done more of a turn in the front. But if you're isolated from your team with three other members of the same team, it's completely different to sitting on the wheel of three other riders from different teams, whereby you're all trying to work for a different outcome. I think it's completely nonsensical to think that the only member of a different team that you would help that team, who are hell-bent on making sure that you lose regardless of which one of them win, that you would work as hard as the rest of them. Whether he should have worked harder, that's debatable, but certainly I don't think any other rider in that situation would have played it any differently, and I thought it was tactically quite brilliant, really.
Yeah, and I don't think even Patrick Lefevre believes what he's saying there. in a bike race, you've got to use whatever you can in that situation to try and get the best result you possibly can. And for Stannard, that was to just sit there and let Etics Quickstep do all of the work. There was no onus on him to contribute whatsoever, particularly as Etics also had a guy in the group behind. You know, they could have called his bluff and said, look, we're not going to drive this on, we'll sit back. And now we've got four guys in this group, but they obviously didn't want to let Van Mark and Van Avermaet back on. So Stannard was using all of those tactical things, you know, against Etics Quickstep in order to get to the position he needed to get into.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So I think we can hear now from three of the actors from Het Nieuwsblad. I was over there in Belgium for the weekend for the two races, and at the finish in Ghent, where I have to say there was quite a big cheer went up when Ian Stannard won, which was quite surprising given that, you know, Etics Quickstep is Belgium's premier team. But it was quite a popular victory. I think people appreciated someone who, in those circumstances, was the underdog winning. Afterwards, I spoke to Servais Canavan, Team Sky's Belgian sports director. We hear first from him, then we hear from Patrick Lefevre, who I spoke to the morning of Kerner Brussels Kerner. Still quite bitter, as we can hear, Patrick Lefevre, the boss of the Etics Quickstep team. And then finally, we hear from Luke Rowe, who did have quite an important role to play in Het Nieuwsblad. He tells us a little bit about how the team celebrated Ian Stannard's victory on Saturday evening.
Are you surprised that Ian was able to beat three Quickstep riders like that?
Surprised. Nieuwsblad is always a really tough race, and especially today with the wind. And you must also understand, in the wheel, it's not really easy and on these roads. So we didn't know what was possible. Of course, he had to try something.
So we saw you go up to him in the car, give him some instructions.
The first concern was the chase group with Stiba in the wheel, like in the same position as Ian. So I wanted to inform him about that, and that he knew that he was fresh, so that if it would come back together. And I said, if they come closer, then you have to work, because otherwise we have no one else behind. So yeah, then you have to just go for the podium. But then the gap went bigger, and then he could stay on the wheel. Yeah, it's a normal thing, I think, to do.
I mean, in a situation like that, three guys from one team, one of the riders, is overconfidence a factor sometimes?
Yeah, they won many times like this, but sometimes you lose as well, because it was like 35 kilometers, pretty long, and almost an hour. Bike racing is about winning the race, and sometimes things like this happen. To be in that situation for Quickstep is also not an easy situation. And I think Yogi was really strong at the end, or Ian was really strong at the end. And Quickstep attacked with Bone and I think Van den Berg. And Ian closed the gaps and then went himself. So I think he was one of the strongest guys in it.
Is a win like that extra satisfying?
Yeah, I was really happy. We are all really, really happy, especially after what happened last year with Ian. And his long fight to come back at this level, and I think he is at the same level or maybe even better than last year. And and I think the main thing is his confidence that he won this race last year, so he know he can do it, and that really helped him today. And he is such a strong, strong engine guy. Yeah, it is incredible. Really, really, really happy for him.
Did you watch the final of the race again last night? Or
yeah.
And what were your thoughts watching it again?
Same. Stannard won again.
Was there anything watching it that you thought we should have done differently?
Afterwards, it's always easy to say we had to do something different. We did what we did, and we lost, and there's a conclusion.
What if you'd had one man in a four-man break like that? What would your instructions to him have been? I mean, would you have played it the same way as Stannard, or would you have worked a bit, given that the chasers were close behind?
Well, if I say this, I'm a bad loser. I saw the reactions already on Twitter. But I'm still convinced if you have a team like Sky and Sir Bradley Wiggins is the whole race riding with you out of the wind and you're in a breakaway for 40 kilometers, then he win. It's a strong rider, but in my eyes, it's not a big win.
Well, you did a great job for the team yesterday. You bridged up to, you know, those escapees. Was that part of a plan?
Not really, to be honest. My bike was broke, so I attacked hoping to get a bit of a gap to be able to change my bike and get back in the peloton. So, and it still didn't end up happening. I had to finish the race on a bit of a broken bike, so that's the reason for the attack.
You finished with a broken bike, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't too bad, but it wasn't ideal.
But you just have the legs then at the time, or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I felt really good. Felt good all day. Even at the end of the race, I felt, you know, I won that bunch gallop, which I wouldn't normally beat them guys. So I still had the legs to continue racing.
Did you watch the finish, the last 5Ks last night, and reflect on how Ian managed to do that?
Yeah, we watched it a couple of times, and even when we were watching it, we knew he'd won, but we still couldn't figure out how he's going to win it with 5K to go, and incredible performance, and he's a really good friend of mine. So it's after the year he had last year with a couple of crashes and mishaps, it's, you know, I'm as pleased as he is that he stands on that top step where he belongs again.
Do you think you're far away from a big result in one of these races?
No, I mean, like, if last year I finished 11th, this year 9th. You know, if you can get them to start getting top 10s, then, you know, realistically one day you can win one. So, you know, hopefully not too far away, but for now I'll do my job and support the guys who need it.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So we heard there from Servus Canavan, quite a bitter Patrick Lefebvre. When I went up to the Etix Quickstep bus to speak to him, he was actually in conversation with a few Belgian journalists, and they were chatting away. There was a lot of hilarity, and it seemed very jovial. A lot of sort of Belgian shrugging, you know, of the kind that we're very familiar with. And I stood awaiting an opportune moment to interrupt with my few questions in English, please, Patrick. And the mood changed completely, and he wasn't particularly as effusive as he can be. Still got that wonderfully deep voice, though. Then we heard from Luke Rowe, who's really maturing into a strong classics rider, and he revealed there that he had finished Het Nieuwsblad on a broken bike, but still outsprinted Arnaud Démare, a very good sprinter, for ninth place. So a very positive result for him, I think. So Patrick Lefebvre did cheer up on Sunday at Kerner, Brussels Kerner, when his team were again pretty dominant, and Mark Cavendish won the race. Lionel, did you watch much of Kerner, Brussels Kerner?
Yeah, I did. I watched the last 80K or whatever that was on Eurosport, and it's always the middle section of that race that's the most interesting because it runs back into Kerner, which is a kind of suburb of Kortrijk, really. It's not the most exciting run in. All of the cobbles and the hills are kind of done and dusted in that middle third. So with about 50K to go, it all regrouped, came back to quite a big group. I was interested to watch Cavendish's climbing style on a couple of the climbs on the Quaremont and the Lieberg particularly, which, you know, he was out of the saddle, he looked good, he looked really sort of sprightly and like he was totally in control. And it was at that point, I know Daniel had been asked on Twitter who he thought would win, and he said Mark Cavendish. I wasn't that confident because I thought Alexander Kristoff would be very difficult to beat, and in the finish he was difficult to beat. It wasn't a sort of Cavendish winning by several lengths, it was a real nip and tuck sprint. But Cavendish just looks really, really good this spring. He got his winter, I think, spot on, and it bodes well for Milan-San Remo coming up later this month.
Kristoff had ridden Het Nieuwsblad as well, so he had that in his legs. A couple of interesting points. So Cavendish, yeah, did look lean, and another thing that Patrick Lefebvre said when I spoke to him, I asked him if he was happy with Mark Cavendish's opening to his season. He said,
"Yes, I looked at dinner last night. I looked at him at dinner last night, and I saw his ass, and I was happy."
I think
what Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation there, Richard, or was that you doing an Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation?
He was putting on a Scottish accent as well. I think he's making the point that he's very lean, and he is, and he was climbing very well. And Candice was asked about that afterwards. He said, "Yeah, I'm not a bad bike rider, you know." He also made a point in his interview with Spurs afterwards that Wilfred Peters, the DS at Etix Quickstep, had apparently not been as confident as the other riders that Cavendish would still be there at the finish and capable of winning. So he felt like a point had been proven there. They've got a bit of history. You know, Peters is a sort of old school Belgian sports director who I think prefers to build the team around a Tom Boonen. If not a Tom Boonen, then Tom Boonen.
The thing as well with Mark Cavendish, I think, tweeting that afterwards, he is someone who, it might sound obvious to say, for any rider that really, really needs the faith of their team. But I remember chatting to Rod Ellingworth, who probably knows Mark Cavendish better than anyone, who took him through the academy, the GB Academy, and coached him up until he joined Omega Pharma Quickstep once again, now Etix Quickstep. And I remember him telling me that Mark really, really needs the faith of his team around him. And I don't think that that means in any way that he needs them to be leading him out, because we all know that he doesn't need a lead out to win. I know that, we all know from 2012 when he was with Team Sky, it really rankled him, that there were several sprints he could have gone for, and the team management decided that they shouldn't compromise a GC. He thought they didn't need to compromise the GC, and there was a stage in the bus beforehand where Bradley Wiggins said, yeah, we're all sprinting for Mark today. And that to him really matters, and I think if he can get that within his team again this year, then it bodes very well. I mean, it's he's the most successful rider so far this year. It's very, very early, but he's won more than any other rider, certainly more than all of his sprint rivals put together. And I think the sprinting this year could be really, really exciting if it adds up to what it looks like it's going to. You're laughing at me, Lionel. Is that?
Awarla is doing a fantastic job here of babysitting, and I was going to draw a parallel there with what you were just talking about. But that made me a bit unkind.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, looking after the sort of team leader, the domestique role, the perfect domestique role there, Awarla. Eve is entirely dependent on you here, isn't she? Just on Etix Quickstep and Wilfred Peters and Mark Cavendish, Peters is the sort of Belgian. He has conformed to the ex-pro, Belgian ex-pro stereotype. He's put on a little bit of weight since retiring. He doesn't give the impression of being the most sort of flexible of team managers. I think he wants to be, you know, the boss in the old school Belgian type way. And I think that's why he gets on well with Lefebvre. But when you see the way the Etix Quickstep team operates when he's around as the lead director sportif, or when Brian Holm is around, it's like it's a completely different atmosphere when Brian is around. I was on Paris-Nice last year where Wilfred Peters was there, and you know, it didn't feel like the sort of cohesive team where everybody's in control and there's quite a relaxed atmosphere. And when Brian's there, it felt a lot more shambolic, really, and you know, old school, and a lot. You just get the impression that Peters would be the one thumping his fist on the table at the end of the Het Nieuwsblad because they cocked up the finish. Whereas, you know, Brian's a lot more sort of sanguine about that, and I think as a result does tend to get more out of the team when he's around.
I think Brian gets more out of Mark as well. I mean, I remember whenever Mark Cavendish joined Quickstep again after Team Sky, I say again, but joined Brian Holm again, former HTC Columbia, we went to one of their team hotels. I can't remember which race it was, but I remember clearly that it was a big race for Mark. And we had this thing going on with a cameraman of ours who has a special way of making people fly in quite an illusionary way. And so we made Mark Cavendish fly through the front windscreen of the team bus. To do so, I won't give away the secrets, but it certainly wasn't something that in Team Sky he would have been allowed to do. And that dynamic with him and Brian, where it's just a bit of fun, but they both take it very seriously, but want to enjoy life as well. I think that works really well between the two of them, and I don't think that necessarily works with Mark whenever it's someone who just lays down the law, and I think that's what he was probably trying to say on Twitter a little bit as well.
Orla has dropped back to the team car to get a bid on for Eve, who is now well-fed for the end of the podcast. We're all good.
Eve's going through a lot of bidons. Has she got enough bidons to see her through this podcast, do you think?
She works very hard. I've got another bidon in my bag, just in case, though. I'm a good DS. I look after her well.
The water carrier, Danny Pate of the podcast team. Brilliant. On the subject of Belgium, another quick thank you to our new sponsor, Van Dessel Cycles, who are launching in Great Britain, available now in Great Britain. They're an American bike brand with a Belgian heritage, as you can guess from the name. A big thank you to them for choosing to partner with the Cycling Podcast for this launch. We're very flattered. So a big thank you to them.
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So what's coming up on British Eurosport, the home of cycling, in the next week? Strada Bianchi on Saturday 7th. An unusual race in that it's new on the calendar, but seems as though it should have been around for about 150 years. It's a beautiful race over the white roads of Tuscany and finishes in the middle of Siena. Doesn't get much more spectacular than that. It was a great race last year. Michał Kwiatkowski and Peter Sagan went away, and it was as if it was we were seeing the future of cycling there. Those two stars, Kwiatkowski obviously went on to become world champion, and he won into Siena. Expecting more of the same on Saturday. It'll also be the comeback race for Simon Gerrans after his broken collarbone. Then we've got Paris-Nice, and you're going there, Lionel. I may be joining you.
Yeah, I am. And we'll be catching up with Rob Hatch, the commentator of British Eurosport there, and Sean Kelly, who's his co-commentator. They'll be on the road as well. I expect we'll catch up with them next week. Great race, Paris-Nice. Perhaps we'll get overshadowed a little bit this year by Tirreno Adriatico because of the big four taking part in the Italian stage race, but my heart is still with Paris-Nice because it's just beautiful to look at, lovely to arrive down on the Côte d'Azur. Hopefully the sun will be shining, the sea will be glistening, and perhaps Bradley Wiggins, or more likely Geraint Thomas, might clinch overall victory on the Col d'Azur. Who knows?
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So before Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner, I attended the Wiggle Honda team launch. They are entering year three. Rochelle Gilmore, the Australian who set the team up, still very much in charge. 15 riders, 8 different nationalities. In women's cycling, the nationality of the team is according to how many riders you have from each country. So still a British team, but a very international one, with an ambition this year of being, by the end of the year, the world's number one ranked team. They are currently number 3 in the world. The sponsors signed up for 3 years, so it's a crucial year. But Rochelle Gilmore is concerned not just with her team, but with the sustainability of women's cycling in the longer term. I spoke to her about her plans for the team for this year, and we can hear from her now.
Yeah, a big part of negotiating sponsorships for a women's pro team now is about understanding where the sport's going. So on a much bigger level than just the pro team, but the structure of women's cycling. And I know that the UCI and organising committees are going to the lengths now to educate the teams on where we're going in the future. Broadcasting rights and figures, facts and figures to understand what we're actually selling here, what assets a women's cycling team actually has to offer. And for a sponsor who wants to invest in women's cycling, I'd say now's the right time, because for the level of investment they need to make, and especially if they secure a team for 2 or 3 years, the sport's rapidly, rapidly developing at a rate of knots.
The Women's Tour was a great success last year in Britain, and it was an event that stood alone. It wasn't like Het Nieuwsblad or Tour Flanders held on the same day as Women's Race Flèche Wallonne. Which is your preference? Is it for women's races to stand alone or to be organised sort of in the shadow of men's races?
Yeah, my preference at this point, right now, would be that we have women's events in conjunction with men's events, and that's because the media are present there, and they'll, over time, realise that, okay, people want, when we cover this, people want to see it, people enjoy seeing it, but they're not actually going to step away from their environment, or companies are not going to put on extra staff and this and that to go cover a women's race, but once we're at a men's race, they cover the racing, they see the response from the general public. I think that right now, the answer to that question is it would be great to have more women's events in conjunction with men's events.
So La Course, for example, was obviously a great step forward, but would you be in favour of a longer women's race in France at the same time as the Tour de France?
I think it would be great to have a women's Tour de France, not as long as the men's, not the stages as long. In conjunction with the men's would be great if it could be logistically possible. I mean, ideally, I'd like to have a 10-day Women's Tour de France event with stages from 120 to 140 kilometres a day. I think that would be fantastic, and run on the same courses as the men, maybe in the morning, finishing on the same start-finish line is really important. And sharing that interest and hype, letting the fans see women and men at the same place. The helicopters are in the air, and just share the whole logistical setup of such a race.
I mean, they did it before, of course, in the 80s. There was a women's Tour de France organised along similar lines. Did that maybe just come too soon? Do you think that the fact that it didn't last was just a matter of timing? Do you think that now, or around now, would be the time to try something like that again?
I think it definitely is the right time now to start it again. Yeah, I wasn't around when that took place, and I can't really understand the reasoning behind why it died off, but I think there's potential to make it work now. I think it's very, very difficult for the organisation to bring in a women's race, but if it was possible or achievable, I think the rewards for everybody involved would be quite satisfying.
You mentioned Nicole Cook earlier, and she's somebody that you knew very well, know very well. She's retired and doesn't seem to be involved in the sport. Would you welcome her involvement in the sport? As she proved in her book, she's got an awful lot to say about the sport and a lot to offer as well.
Yeah, it's very difficult for me to answer that question. I know that when Nicole was in the sport, very, very passionate about increasing the level and standard for the women that she was, representing. She did go out of her way to try and bat for better conditions. Now I've heard some of the comments that have been a little bit negative, and it disappoints me because things don't happen overnight. That may be just what is holding her back from being more influential in the sport, wanting it to happen now. A lot of people are investing in this, working really, really hard towards it, but you can't just say we want this and have it tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because there's a lot of ground to make up on the, and lots of years of history to make up on the men's sport. Is it demoralising at times? How do you sort of keep that positive attitude?
No, not demoralising at all, and always positive, because for me there is so many small wins every day in all the different organisations that we're working with, and people's attitudes are changing, and that's something that's driving me.
Okay, so if you were UCI president, what three things would be your top priorities for improving women's cycling?
Gaining TV coverage, which they've done. They've invested, and they're investing more each year into that. Secondly, something that they've not done yet is take responsibility for the level of standard that a professional team has to meet for an environment. They are introducing that within the next couple of years, working on it very closely now. So TV coverage, responsibility. Well, maybe even perhaps the first thing, I don't know if it's third on the list, but that's to gather information. That's one very, very important thing, and they have started to do that now. They are actively going out there to gather information from the athletes, from the teams, from the sponsors, from the broadcasters, from the race organisers. They are out there in the field every single day gathering information to make our sport a professional sport.
And Brian Cook's one of the things that he stood on for UCI president was to promote women's cycling, do a better job for women's cycling. What's your verdict a year into his presidency, and what's your relationship like with him?
1 year into his presidency, I think job done. What he achieved in the last 12 months with women's cycling, and that the core of that is the fact that there is UCI representative specifically focused on developing women's cycling. That hasn't existed for the last 10 years that I have been in the sport. We've shared one guy that's been responsible for under 23s, this and that and this, and yeah, women's cycling, not top priority. There is a group of people now appointed at the UCI to make women's cycling top priority. So for me, that's a big step that he made. Yes, they invested money into TV production. Now fans and followers can watch the World Cup series on TV. So he's done a couple of significant things that, haven't been done for 10 years. And then we get one new guy in and it's done. So I'm very appreciative of that. My personal relationship is not super close. I'm more close with the vice president, obviously, Tracy Gaudry, who's Australian. So I, get my messages to Brian through her quite often. And things are happening.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So we heard there from Rochelle Gilmore talking about Wiggle Honda and her plans for her team and for the sport. Interesting that her preference is for women's events to be held in conjunction with men's events. I mean, an example for me was Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday when there was a women's race as well. And it was so kind of low-key compared to the men's race. You wouldn't even know that the race was finishing when it did. And this is a real challenge, I think. Sometimes I feel that when races stand on their own, such as the Women's Tour, they have a better chance of breaking through, of attracting an audience. What do you think, Orla? I think you disagree with me on that.
I think I do. I think I agree with Rochelle, because I think the logistics, not just of organising a race, but certainly from a broadcast point of view, which is a massive part of getting, obviously, publicity for a race, the fact that you have a news crew on the ground makes a big, big difference. And I think if you have them in conjunction, I've always been a big fan of going back to the old school Tour de France, whereby you have the women and the men's in conjunction to a certain extent. From a broadcast point of view, apart from nationally and dodgy streams across the world, it goes under the radar anyway, apart from the written press. Although we're excited about the weekend's racing, is the wider sporting world that excited about it? Probably not. You need to have the broadcasters on board. And for broadcasters to be on board, it's a massive expense. You've got to send, for any race that we send to, for example, a men's race, we've got to justify why we're sending a reporter, for example, a producer, cameraman, a satellite truck engineer, and hotels, flights. Even my daughter's balking at the thought of it. But, you know, all of those things have to be justified. If you can have the two together with enough impetus to have the women's race at least covered, then you're off to a head start. But that's the problem. That's the problem, is that you don't have people covering necessarily the men's race, and Richard is almost biting at the microphone here to have a say. Go, go.
You've covered the Tour de France, Orla. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you there. You run off your feet. Would you have the capacity for also covering an additional race?
I think so. My problem is that I wasn't at last year's Tour de France. So I don't have that experience from last year of covering the women's race ahead of the men's race. Certainly, though, I think it takes a dedication, but I was full on for wanting to do it. It would take a longer day, but at the same time, you know, to go back to what I'm talking about, logistics and expense, which, to be brutal, is what it's all about. You're paying for satellite truck all day. If I'm standing on the Champs-Élysées waiting on a race to start, I'm still there from 6 o'clock in the morning, waiting on the race to start, talking about the race that just has been for the previous 3 weeks. Our satellite engineer is there, the cameraman is there, the producer is there. We're waiting, we're trying to find interviews, we're building up all day. Whereas if we had the women's race, we'd be talking about something else while we're waiting. And that sounds like I'm being flippant about the women's racing, and I'm not. It would just give us an extra impetus. It would give extra excitement to the day, extra racing, and extra racing coverage for them. And I think, to me, it's a no-brainer that they would be in the same day, because if you are on location for the entire day, unless, you know, you're lazy and you want to lie in bed until the men's race rolls through, then Richard's pulling a face as if to say, yep, that'll be me.
No,
I honestly think it's so obvious as to be disingenuous that it should be done.
I mean, it was very inspiring, actually, speaking to Rochelle Gilmore, because, you know, she has such a vision for the sport, and she's so realistic about how long it will take. Mm. You know, I think that she was frustrated by the frustration of someone like Nicole Cook, who she said wants change to happen overnight. It's going to take a long time. Your colleague Leah Hervey has said, like chucking stones in a river, and eventually you'll have a bridge across. I think that's a very, very good analogy. We should mention that Anna van der Breggen won on Saturday, Het Nieuwsblad, the women's Het Nieuwsblad. Very similar story to Ian Stannard, and she was also coming back from a very serious injury, broke her pelvis in the women's team time trial at the World Championships last year. So it was a good story there. But you're right, or rather Rochelle is right, I think, that things are improving. We can see progress happening, but it's going to take a long, long time. I had dinner as part of the Wiggle Honda team launch, a dinner with the riders on Thursday evening in Ghent, and they were a really nice bunch. And part of the reason they were so engaging and engaged is because they are professionals, really, only in name, most of them. They are doing it because it's a passion. You know, I was sort of challenged, asked, you know, how much do you think we earn? And it was fascinating. I mean, I'll not go into any figures, but most of the women's, the female riders in the women's peloton are doing it because it's because it's something they love to do.
I mean, I've mentioned on this podcast a few times the comparison between men and women cycling. Go back to the Olympic road race in London. I think if you have one race followed by another, then you will see the difference in racing. And because the men's racing is so much more controlled generally, you could say, I guess, professional in, to a certain extent, in that they have very strict team tactics. They've got very strict modus operandi. The women's racing is much more dynamic, it's much more exciting, and I think if you saw one race followed by the other, you would notice that, and that would do the world of good for women's racing, because I think it is much more exciting.
From a British perspective and a media perspective, I mean, we're talking about the profile of the women's sport, and I think the women's tour last May suffered a little bit because it clashed with the Giro d'Italia, which was starting in Belfast and then going down to Dublin, so that dragged a little bit of the attention away. That won't happen this year, of course, but we had two British winners this weekend at Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner. Ian Stannard, who may not necessarily sort of tip the radar of national newspaper sports editors, but Mark Cavendish certainly would. The difficulty of getting that weekend's racing, Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner, onto the radar of the national press is it's very, very difficult, because they want to know, will they win? And I couldn't have said on Friday, Mark Cavendish will win on Sunday and Ian Stannard will win on Saturday. I could only say, well, Ian Stannard won it last year, Mark Cavendish has won it in the past. I think last year, this weekend's races clashed with the World Track Championships, so, you know, they didn't get the coverage then. This year, you know, road racing is still not the sort of things that command 700, 800, 900 words on of coverage in a national Sunday newspaper. And so even the men's side, even with all of that going for it, I'm not sure many of the national papers carried more than a line in the news in brief this weekend. So, you know, even the men's side is coming from such a long way back. The Tour de France, fine. The World Championships, fine. To an extent now, the Giro and some other races. But cycling hasn't yet sort of punched through to have, you know, that place on that bigger stage.
I totally agree with you. And cycling will struggle to make it onto the radar, especially when it's not, as you say, the Tour de France and whatnot. But if you flip it on its side, then, you know, people have been critical in the past about national allegiance in cycling, and especially towards Team Sky, and you know, it should be more international and whatnot. But there is an argument then for saying that it helps the sport to actually get behind the riders of your nationality. I mean, I was looking this morning, and if you look at the total wins this year for Team Sky, you know, the British are back up to the best that they've been on the road. And while internationally, the Brits, and, you know, put my hand up, born, brought up Irish, but, the Brits have come under criticism in the media for getting too much behind the cyclists. But unless they do, then does it really make the back pages? I don't think it does. So they've got an awful lot of stiff competition to fight when it comes to the sporting coverage. And maybe it's up to the media as much to push that as the riders. I don't know.
Well, we can hear what Eve thinks about the lack of coverage over the weekend, I think. She's not happy at all, is she?
She was watching avidly. She was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We should probably talk about the ongoing story of Astana, or Astana, if we had Rob Hatch with us and we were trying to impress him with our pronunciation. But Astana, it's an ongoing story. There's no real, nowhere near a conclusion. You know, we're talking about Nibali riding Tirreno Adriatico. At the moment, it's as you were. They are being referred back to the UCI Licence Commission, with the UCI taking a view, I think, that they've not been cooperating with the special audit that's been conducted by the University of Lausanne. That's what we think is happening. There's still a long way to go. I think even if the licence is revoked, it'll end up in the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And, you know, at the moment, we're nowhere near a resolution on that, but it's a pretty ugly situation.
Yeah, and I wonder, with the Cycling Independent Reform Commission report due soon as well, whether there will be ramifications for other teams as well as Astana.
I think the difficulty as well with Astana, or Astana, however you want to pronounce it, we all spoke to Oleg Tinkoff at the start of the year, and I think his almost ambiguity on it summed up the difficulty of it, whereby he said that on the face of it, if there's that much evidence against a team, they shouldn't have a licence. But also, he thought there was no evidence of any systematic doping within the team, and it was just individuals. So thereby you can't really deny a team a licence if it is individuals.
Well, we'd love to know what the University of Lausanne, the people who have been assigned to the team, what they have discovered, or whether they have been kept at a distance. I just wonder if Astana thought that this audit was a bit of lip service and that they didn't take it very seriously. We don't know at this stage, but it would be fascinating to know exactly what the problem has been there. This is going to be an ongoing story. We'll return to it, I'm sure. But we need to thank once again our new sponsors. Very grateful to British Eurosport and to Van Dessel. And as I said, we'll be telling you more about Van Dessel in the coming weeks. Thank you also to Jonathan Rowe, who made his debut as producer-editor last week and has returned this week, a listener who volunteered his services, and we're very grateful to Jonathan. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Eve. Eve waving's not really going to work on the podcast. You're gonna have to
She's got a lot to learn.
It reminds me of Sean Kelly nodding on radio.
Well, she does have Irish blood, doesn't she? I think. Orla, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm nodding. You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for signing up as a friend today at the very last moment before coming along.
I still don't have the nappies that you said you'd give me in return, I have to say, Richard. So at the moment, my daughter's losing out because I'm selfishly following my cycling obsession, but we'll not go there. That's for another podcast, perhaps.
You did say that joining the friend scheme was basically the same as buying a packet of nappies. Two packets of nappies. So there you go. You can become a friend of the Cycling Podcast, www.thecyclingpodcast.com. Get 11 exclusive special podcasts for the price of two packets of nappies.
That's pretty much a podcast, a nappy, really. There you go.
Listening to the Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.